Hey guys, and welcome to a brand new episode of Nerds Talk Movies. My name is Taylor. I'm going to be your host today. Joining me is not Drew Garrison. Drew is not here today, unfortunately. He had some stuff come up. But I am joined by somebody who missed last week, and that is Tristan Benz. Tristan, how you doing, man?
I tell you what, Taylor, you know, I've been better. See, what had happened last weekend was these seagulls framed me for, like, a serial killer thing. They thought that I was committing a bunch of crimes once a month, but, like, based on other types of birds. So I had to go, you know, off the grid for a bit and try and, you know, clear my name, as it were. So, you know, fingers crossed that they don't dig up some other type of falsified dirt on me. But, you know, these gulls are crafty. I mean, I have it on good authority that they ripped Drew's teeth out to get at me. That's why he's not here.
So I know you didn't listen to our show last week, but last week I challenged Drew. I kind of gave him some constructive criticism, and he had a seagulls bit as well. And I was like, you and Tristan with these seagulls, the continuity on this bit is
it's history.
The history on this bit is just all over the place. So I challenged him, you and him, to get together, figure this out, get it down on paper so, you know, it's more cohesive of a story or history, as you like to put it. And I do have to admit, I love the spin you put on it today.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm just relaying to you, you know, what happened. This saga, if you will, with us and these
saga.
Gulls. You know,
the seagull saga. Move over multiverse saga.
Oh, who cares about the multiverse nerds talk? Saga? It's all about the goals. It's all about the goals.
All about the goals. Let's go ahead and get into this here today because I want to hear your thoughts on this since you weren't here last week. You saw the title. You clicked on this episode. You know the deal. Today we are going to be talking about Batman: The Long Halloween Part 2. We've already watched and posted our retrospective on part one, so if you haven't watched that or listened to it, because this is a podcast,
if you want to stare at your screen, you can watch it, you know?
I guess that's the case.
I don't know what they would get out of that, but they could do it. They could watch the little, you know, like, time bar go across the bottom of the screen.
Yeah, I guess so. But it was a really fun episode, and a lot of the stuff we talked about there will probably be brought up again here. Here's a synopsis for The Long Halloween Part 2, courtesy of IMDb. Quote, the killer known as Holiday continues to stalk the Falcone crime family while a new class of costumed criminal rises in Gotham City. Batman suspects that a former ally might be the serial killer. End quote. And here is some of the main cast for the film, along with director and writer credits. Again, this is coming from IMDb. The film was directed by Chris Palmer. It's based on the graphic novel by Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale.
R.I.P. Tim Sale.
We'll also be talking about the final film credit for Naya Rivera, who plays Catwoman, which is just...
Also
really I didn't dope. Know how she even died before, like, doing the research for the last
know?
Episode.
Oh, yeah,
no, and it's really tragic, man. No. It's fucking... it's horrible. But nothing really changes in terms of the screenplay credits. Also, the screenplay was done by Tim Sheridan. As for the voice cast, we have Jensen Ackles as Batman / Bruce Wayne, Josh Duhamel as Harvey Dent / Two-Face, as we just talked about, Naya Rivera voicing Catwoman / Selina Kyle in her final film, Troy Baker voicing the Joker, Layla Berzins voicing Sophia Falcone, Billy Burke as Commissioner Gordon, Zach Callison as young Bruce Wayne, David Dasmalchian as Calendar Man and the Penguin.
Man doing double duty.
David Dasmalchian, if you don't know, played Polka Dot Man in The Suicide Squad. He was also in The Dark Knight.
And he's also in later in 2049 and Ant-Man and CW's The Flash. This man's in everything. And he's in Dune.
He's just everywhere.
Yeah.
Alyssa Diaz voicing Renee Montoya. John DiMaggio, the voice of Bender, voicing Mad Hatter, Robin Atkin Downs voicing Scarecrow and Thomas Wayne, pulling double duty there. Alistair Duncan voicing Alfred Pennyworth. If you have played the recent God of War games, Duncan voices Mimir in the most recent God of War and the upcoming Ragnarok. So that's pretty cool.
And he has previously voiced Alfred Pennyworth in The Batman, the cartoon from the early 2000s.
Gary Leroy Gray as Pierce, Amy Landecker as Barbara Gordon and Carla Vitti, Julie Nathanson as Gilda Dent. Julie Nathanson, if you're a video game player and a Call of Duty fan, she voiced Samantha Maxis in Call of Duty Black Ops Cold War. Jim Peary voicing Sal Maroney. Katie Sackhoff voicing Poison Ivy. And I'm laughing there because Katie Sackhoff at this point, I feel like, is a really recognizable name. So, you know where Katie Sackhoff's from. Mandalorian, Battlestar Galactica. There's a bunch of credits.
That there. Power Rangers fan film.
Fred Tatasciore as Solomon Grundy and Vincent Falcone. Rick D. Wasserman as a bodyguard. I don't know which one. That's what IMDb has here. And Titus Welliver as Carmine Falcone and Luigi Maroney.
See, I got beef with this IMDb list. First of all, too long, you know, just in general. But why in tarnation is Titus Welliver's Carmine Falcone all the way at the bottom below, no offense to Rick D. Wasserman, but bodyguard? Like, Carmine Falcone is an actual, like, major character in this movie.
I think it's one of those things that, like, in the order of this movie, you know, sometimes in the cast, they'll be like, and also, and it's this,
I mean, yeah,
well-respected actor or actress, and I think that's what they're doing here with
Titus Welliver. And that would make sense, because, like, if it's doing, like, you know, the little motion graphics, you know, for the cast at the opening or the end, whatever, that's all well and good. But you wouldn't include just bodyguard in that motion graphic, you know? Who's Pierce? Who's Gary Leroy? Who is Pierce in this? Why is he right under Alfred, but like above even Poison Ivy or Solomon Grundy? You know,
I can see the gripe you have with this.
I'm just saying, and young Bruce Wayne, he's in like two scenes. Come on,
that's very true. I think only one scene actually.
he's in two. Well, he only speaks in one scene because there's also the flashback of his parents getting killed. Because it's not a Batman story unless you get a flashback to dead parents.
And also, Titus Welliver, Drew was talking about Bosch himself last week. And, you know, I'm very disappointed in myself that I didn't address this last week. This is also the man in black from Lost. He's in many other things. That's what I mostly know him from because, man, he did a great job with very small amount of screen time. So, Titus Welliver, the man in black in Lost.
He's also playing Lex Luthor in this upcoming season of Titans.
That's a great casting. I gotta admit. I think that's way better than their Bruce Wayne casting. I'll give them that. So, again, last week we talked about how star-studded this voice cast really is and how great these performances were. I get the feeling we're going to be talking about that again in today's show because the cast only got better with the new additions that we had. Drew already broke down the comic connections for us last week, too, so we're going to be skipping that segment this week. Instead, Tristan, you weren't here.
I wasn't here.
You couldn't share your very opinionated thoughts on Batman and the Long Halloween Part 1. So instead, I just want to get your thoughts on Part 1 before we get into our actual retrospective.
It's a lot of build-up, you know, but it's enjoyable build-up. It's a banger. I mean, I'm biased because Batman the Long Halloween is shockingly, I'm sure, to all the fans out there, like one of my favorite Batman stories, period. I mean, it's one of the most famous for good reasons. It's a great story, and I mean, it's influenced, obviously, this adaptation, but, you know, The Dark Knight and even The Batman to a certain extent. So clearly it's, you know, it's got some type of magic going on with it. But I think that the first half of this, you know, this two-part film is a really, really solid launching off point for this movie. And they do take a couple, I don't know if I'd say liberties. I'm sure Drew mentioned it, but there's a few variations they make from the source material that I think makes it flow more cohesively as a two-part, you know, movie, since they needed to split up all the stuff with, like, the, well, I mean, we'll get into it later, but, you know, that baby subplot that we'll dive into more. Like, that's the Gilda's relationship with Falcone, or the Falcone family, wasn't really a thing in the comics. So them bringing that and added a level of intrigue that I really enjoyed. But no, I really enjoy the first half. I have a couple, not full-on criticisms, but slightly bigger than nitpicks, however you want to quantify that in your brain. But overall, it's pretty enjoyable. I'd say it's one of the more solid, and especially combined with this, one of the more solid DC animated movies from the last 10 years, because, you know, they kind of fell off for a bit doing those New 52 adaptations, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, I agree with you on pretty much everything you said there, even as somebody who doesn't really know the source material like that. Last week, we're going to be doing the same thing again, where I'm going to be giving out kind of like a summary of the story as well, so people who haven't watched the movie in a while can kind of like, okay, so I know where they're at, what they're talking about exactly. For part one, I thought it was much easier for me to write that summary. Part two, you even sent a message to me a few hours ago, like, this is pretty detailed. It's because, to me, they packed a lot of stuff in part two. So part one, I think it's all about that build up, and I think you talked about that perfectly. Like, that's exactly what it is. It's all about that build up. So it's one of the burdens that part two has that we're going to talk about. It's just, it's having to cram a lot in there. That's like, hey, we couldn't talk about it here because we'd reveal everything. So it's just unfortunate that part two has to do a lot of the heavy lifting. But let's go ahead and talk about part two. What are your general thoughts on this movie, man?
I mean, clearly, I enjoy it. It's hard to talk about this one without talking about the first one, because, you know, as I mentioned, and as y'all talked about, I'm sure, last week, because, admittedly, you're right, I didn't...
It was hard to not talk about part two.
Yeah.
While talking about
it's
part
because
one.
These do feel like one long movie. The part one is just such rising action that this feels not necessarily like all climax, because you do still have that build up to the climax, but it's definitely on like a, okay, now things are finally paying. It feels more like the latter half of a season of television, you know? So
yeah, 100%.
On its own, would this stand alone as the best, like just this 1 hour and 27 minutes on its own, would this stand as the best Batman animated movie of all time? No. But that's like talking about, you know, not even half a season of television, like half an episode, really. So I think it's good. It's, you know, I know a lot of people in general prefer the first half. They think that's a better story, and I think I would agree with that. I would think the first half stands on its own more than this one does, but because there's so much payoff in this, and you get to see, like, you know, all the villains, you finally get to see Batman stopping a bitch and, you know, working with Catwoman competently and without being, I don't need a partner, you know, all that jazz. And you find,
oh, we'll talk about Batman kind of being a bitch. Yeah, I like the character development, but at the beginning of the movie especially, it's just like, it's, you both like Batman for it, and also you hate him. Mm-hmm. It's just like, all right, dude,
it's like, Bruce, you need help sometimes. And then you also get to see Josh Duhamel as finally become Two-Face, which, in general, some of the voice cast, I think, isn't necessarily my favorite. They seem a little stiff, but Josh Duhamel as Two-Face is not one of them. He fucking steals the show.
Yeah, we're about to talk about performances. Josh Duhamel, especially in part two, where he gets more... It's not that he gets more to do, it's that he gets the other side of the coin,
yeah.
Pun intended.
I mean, even when he's just doing Harvey Dent, like, I still feel like he's carrying a lot of the emotional... I mean, this is as much of a Harvey Dent story as a Batman story, even in the comics. So, yeah, Harvey Dent as a character carries a lot of that emotional weight. But Josh Duhamel's performance, I think, really, like, does a solid job carrying that over from the comic.
And I think what you just said kind of sums up... It just sums up what I feel about part two. And that's it. It's such a great Harvey Dent story that I think I compared it a little bit to how, like, The Dark Knight handled Harvey Dent and how great Aaron Eckhart was. And I think people don't talk about Aaron Eckhart's performance as much because, you know, Heath Ledger steals the show in that movie. So I think in this, though, this is definitely Josh Duhamel's time to shine, and he just crushes it every opportunity. The writing for the character is amazing. I love the characterization, and I can't wait to get into the ending of the movie because it's one of my favorite, like, endings for Batman and, like, one of his villains. But in terms of just general thoughts here, I thought this was great. I did enjoy part one more, I think, but there's also aspects that I love about part two that I don't get without all the build up of part one. What you said about this just being, I don't think this really just, you can look at it as standalone. It's kind of like you said about, like, there are two sides of a television season. That's what it is, really. It's not like Infinity War and Endgame, to where you can watch both and get enjoyment out of it and really love both standalone. It's not that. Unfortunately, but it doesn't need to be that. It can be exactly what we were talking about, being both sides of a television season, basically. And I think it pulls that off very well. And one of the reasons I think it pulls that off well is because of the voice cast. I know you said it wasn't your favorite,
but I don't think anyone does a bad job. Let me put that out there. I think everyone does like a decent job. It's just a few line deliveries. Like, it's it. And here's the thing. I think it's mainly from Jensen Ackles, which is weird.
He's a great actor. He did a way better job in part one.
Yeah.
I'll say that.
But it's like, I don't know, some of it just feels stiff. Like when he's doing the I'm Bruce Wayne and I'm charming and oh, you know, that woman's husband doesn't like me, like nails that. And then even when he's doing just the straight up Batman voice, I feel like there's, and I don't know. To me, I feel like there's not enough variation.
Do you think it's also because he did so well as Red Hood and Under the Red Hood?
Yeah, and you don't want to replicate that. But I feel like it's I think it's that his, like, Bruce, when he's not putting on an act, sounds too much like his regular Batman voice, which obviously they're the same person. And, you know, it's not always adapted that, you know, Bruce changes his voice. But it felt like if you're going to change it a little bit, you may as well change it like all the way, you know, like go further with it. Not like, you know, Christian Bale, you know, where is she? But it's still just like, okay, you're talking slightly deeper now. If someone just walks by you in the mansion while you're just doing your normal, like serious Bruce voice, and then they run into Batman, like, oh, that's fucking Bruce Wayne, you know?
I do agree with you though. I think Jensen Ackles, I think he did a way better job in part one. And I do think it's a little bit, at least for me, that he did so, so good as Red Hood that it is a little hard to be like, all right, he was Jason Todd. Now he's Batman? I bought it in part one. In part two, maybe it's also because I think everybody like really ups their game in part two.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if we're talking kind of lowlights here, unfortunately, Troy Baker is also in that list for me. Mm-hmm. Mainly because he has nothing to do.
Yeah, he doesn't really get anything to do. That's the thing. He's a glorified set dressing, which, you know, I'm fine with personally because we talk about this. I'm not like the biggest Joker fan. I don't think he needs to be the biggest, you know, focal point for every Batman story. Like sometimes I do like it when, like, yes, obviously he's Batman's greatest enemy, but Batman's got intense relationships with all his bad guys. So sometimes Batman's going to be dealing with one specific thing that's not Joker related. And when there's a whole gang of people there and Joker's not the one in charge, yeah, like obviously Joker's going to take a back seat.
And I talked about this in part one to where I don't think Troy Baker gets enough credit for like doing, it feels like he's doing a Mark Hamill impression, but he's putting his own spin on it towards his own thing. And his Joker voice is very good in my opinion.
Yes, it is.
It's just unfortunate that part one, even though I also told this story to where like, when I first watched this is my second time watching this movie. First time watching this, I was really jokered out. I'm still kind of jokered out, but I was so refreshed. I was like, finally, a movie that doesn't have the Joker. And then midway through the first part, oh, let's inject some Joker. Ah, shit. All right. It worked for the movie, and in retrospect, watching it now, it's great, but it's still one of those things that the character's so played out that is just, you gotta do a lot. And for part two, I don't think he did much because there was no writing for the character. But yeah, great casting, great voice work across the board for me. Let's go ahead and talk about this movie though. Talk about the first three holidays. The movie begins with a montage skipping through Valentine's Day, St. Patrick's Day, and April Fool's Day. The holiday killer has been going after both sides of the impending Falcone and Moroni war, along with the person who has been supplying the holiday killer with their guns. Harvey Dent and Gordon are still working the case. Harvey's marriage is almost completely in shambles, and Batman is nowhere to be seen. Meanwhile, we see that Bruce Wayne has been up to since the post-credit scene from part one that saw Poison Ivy, who was hired by Carmine Falcone, indoctrinate Bruce. Ivy has pretty much been putting Bruce's consciousness in a dreamlike state, while his physical body is just signing over various Wayne assets to the Falcone family. Catwoman would eventually save the day as we get our first major action sequence of the film featuring Catwoman versus Poison Ivy. Bruce, however, doesn't seem too grateful for Catwoman's help, though.
He doesn't need a partner, Taylor.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we're going to be talking about that, because it's part of Bruce's arc in both films, I think. It's a great arc, but mm-hmm. it's definitely a big part of it is him thinking, I got to do this alone. So what are your thoughts on this intro, man?
Well, let me take a sip of water because I'm about to go off. Hold on. I'm just kidding. I'm not about to go off that hard. I just got thirsty. Oh. But no, I
I was about to say, damn, man. I didn't think
yeah,
it was
no,
bad.
No, I mean, it's a solid intro. It jumps like right into it. And by I don't even mean just like the intro of like, oh, setting up that Bruce is in this way of Ivy and seeing these killings. But I'm talking about like from the moment you press play. It, like, is immediately into the title sequence. It's a quick title sequence, and you're like, bam. You're right. We're right where we left off. Like, shit's popping off.
Well, it's like I said, this movie has so much to do.
Yeah.
It's got to. Like, we don't have time to fuck around.
Yeah. Although, like I was saying, side note, the opening, like, title sequence, with the music's great. Like, the art style is great. Well, I should say the design style is great. The art style is obviously fantastic because they're taking frames from the comic, you know, featuring that just amazing Tim Sale art, which if there's any takeaway from these last two episodes, I'm sure Drew said it last week, but read the comic. Read Batman The Long Halloween. Tim Sale's art is just gorgeous, and everyone should enjoy it, especially now that he's passed, because we're not going to get more of it. But
I did want to get your thoughts while talking about like the art and stuff. What are your thoughts on animation of this movie?
Well,
I don't
want to
veer you off too
much. No, you're good. Because we were going to get to it anyway, because this is one of my nitpicks. I think the art style itself is solid. I like it's got that consistency with Superman, Man of Tomorrow, because they're building this new shared universe. So that's all well and good. Mm-hmm. Like it's a good house style for these.
That
and
the Flash movie.
Yeah. And the JSA, you know, World War II, whatever, and the Green Lantern, and War Bar, which I haven't watched, but I've heard mixed things, which makes me sad, because it seems like the only Green Lantern thing Tristan's getting for a long time, and,
I'm sorry, buddy.
I know, it's hard. It really it's hard. Sucks. It's really hard, but anyway,
Hey, it could be worse, he could be a Flash fan.
But at least the Flash has the TV show, you know?
Yeah,
it's mid, but it has its good
it's
moments.
Not a good thing anymore.
Here's the thing. They're still making Flash stuff. It's not necessarily good, but
hey,
they're
good
moving
point.
Heaven and earth to get this movie out. Taylor, good just point. As a total digression, when's the last time you heard any updates on the Green Lantern HBO Max show?
The last thing I remember reading, it was when we were doing Nerds Talk Movies as a movie and news kind of thing. And I don't even know you were part of the podcast team at that point, because we were talking about the casting for, who was it? Who's the
it
main
was Sinestro.
It?
That was one of, like, the first times I was on there as a regular. That's how long it's been.
Oh, my. Dude, that is really the last time I think anything. We might be completely wrong, but to me, that feels
they've,
like the last
I mean, that's
the
last bit of, like, relevant thing. There's been a couple things here and there, like, oh, pre-production's supposed to start now. Pre-production's supposed to start now. Like, they just keeps. I don't know when it's supposed to start. Even the actors are like, yeah, I don't know when it's starting. Like, but I digress. Anywho, back to the art style for this. It's a solid house style, but I do wish that they had an art style that was more similar to the Tim Sale stuff, which his stuff is very stylized and iconic, so it would be hard to, I guess, replicate that for a full animated feature, and especially one that's, like, you know, set within a existing continuity, but it does feel like a missed opportunity to me, at least on like the, you know, the cover art for the, you know, DVD or something like that.
Yeah, totally get you. I think it was one of those things. I think Drew and I, not to speak what his thoughts were, but I think he enjoyed it. I enjoyed it too, the art style. There were some moments, I think, with cars moving or characters moving where they'd be a little wonky.
The cars looking like strangely 3D or whatever.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, a lot of the action sequences are great.
Yeah.
But there are one or two of them that you're like, it reminds me a little bit, and I brought this example up, of Spider-Verse. But it's not as good as Spider-Verse.
Like, oh, yeah. Well, what is?
Well, the first 20 minutes you're watching Spider-Verse, you're kind of thinking, I don't know if I like this. Because it's just so different, and it's kind of like hurting
a moment for your eyes to adjust.
Yeah, but once you do, it's so unique, and you're just, oh my god, it's kind of like a comic. And that's what I kind of equated it to for this.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that I don't think animation is completely up to par for what I think DC's standard should be for that. So I think this is also a brand new universe. They could always improve upon it in new movies. So it's not bad. If it was bad, I'd be far more alarmed.
Oh, no. And it worked. I think it worked really well for Superman. But I think part of its advantage for Superman was, despite, like, you know, a lot of the hardcore Superman fans having this pre-existing idea of what, you know, Metropolis looks like, it's, you know, supposed to be the city of tomorrow and all that stuff. In general, with adaptations, I feel like outside of Superman the Animated Series, which had a very, you know, pronounced and prominent art style for Metropolis that is fantastic and probably the best Metropolis has looked outside the comics, Metropolis tends to get adapted a little bit more liberally, we'll say, in terms of its designs, because it doesn't have, aside from like the skyline of the Daily Planet and whatever Lex's building looks like, it doesn't have that sort of same, just iconic, like, this is what Metropolis is supposed to look like that Gotham has. Like, even though its skyline changes from adaptations, everyone knows, like, the vibe of Gotham City. So when you come into a Batman adaptation with this specific art style, they have less room to work with, I would say, in terms of how they want to make their Gotham look, because so many people have such a strong idea of what that is. So then fitting that into this art style, it doesn't leave a lot of room for, like, these more, not necessarily characterized, but more dramatic adaptations and variations on, you know, landmarks and even characters.
Yeah, totally getcha. But back to
the opening, though. It's good.
Sorry,
it's good
for opening. That.
Good, cool Catwoman, Poison Ivy fight, you know. It's like, man, Bruce, you're losing all your money, King. I need someone to wake you up. And then Selina comes in, is like, oh, well, there you go. Selina's on it. She's there. And he's like, oh, I don't need a partner. Yeah, you all clearly do. Cause the only other quote unquote partner you have is Alfred. And guess what? He was under her snare too. So come on, Bruce, stop being a little baby back bitch.
She saved your money and your life. Like, come on now. That's two fantastic things right there. I feel like Bruce Wayne could have been a little, even in character, could have been like, I appreciate it, but I don't need a partner. Like, that part, it kind of got me at the beginning. I was like, all right, now. You were getting out of that, Bruce. What, like, the fuck, man? I'm right there with you, though. It's a great intro. And yeah, I'm kind of saying that jokingly because it is part of Bruce's story throughout the whole time and part of, like, him growing as Batman, him learning to become a better detective, taking advice from all these characters, learning that, you know, maybe I can't do this all alone. Maybe I need people like Alfred and Selina to help me out. And maybe eventually, you know, maybe a Robin in this universe.
Mayhaps.
I think that's where they're going. So I thought this was a great intro. Funny story, by the way. I told Drew this last week, but when I watched part one for the first time, I did not know there was a post-credits scene, so I went directly into part two, and it took about 20 minutes for me to be like, what's going on? Like,
what's happening here?
I guess this is what happened in the comics? I don't know. So when I saw the post-credits scene for the first time for this retrospective, I was like, oh my god, everything makes so much more sense. Yeah, though, I just love seeing also Poison Ivy in this new role. That's not, I want to just, the environmentalist role that she usually has. Instead, that she still has that, but she's also a bit of a mercenary. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. Well, because this is also like earlier in her evolution as, you know, the Poison Ivy. So she becomes more and more that eco warrior as time goes on. But right here, it's like she's just starting out. She's, I mean, clearly she knows how to use her abilities, but she's still relatively new, you know, to being Ivy. So, you know, it's cool to see her and really most of the rogues of Gotham in general, like sort of finding their footing.
Yeah, and that's a through line for the entire movie. And I can't wait to hear your thoughts on like one of the themes of this new era of villains. Because Drew and I had like a 20-30 minute discussion, it felt like, about how much of an impact Batman had on him. Or if he did at all. How much did the mobs have on it? So I think that's going to be interesting when we get to it. But let's talk about Mother's Day. We skip forward to Mother's Day. Scarecrow has escaped from Arkham Asylum via horse, which is just an awesome detail. I believe it's said that another inmate escaped as well, but I may have misheard that part. But if so, that was some solid foreshadowing for another classic Batman villain we'd see later on. Batman attempts to stop Scarecrow, but the latter is able to use his fear toxin to escape. Batman is really struggling with this dose of fear toxin, and unfortunately, we as the audience have to endure yet another sighting of the Wayne murders.
Unfortunately? Oh, no, that's the best part of every Batman adaptation.
All right, you don't have to lie to the people.
If I'm not seeing his parents get murdered, how will I know why he's the Batman?
Just gonna move on. Just gonna move on. I know what you're doing here.
I mean, I'll say this. I'll say this. Obviously, we're all sick to death, you know, pun intended, of seeing the Waynes die. But doing it during, like, you know, a fucking Scarecrow gas thing, that at least makes sense organically. It's not like the Batman Telltale games where every 5 minutes they're like, we're sorry about your dead parents. And then you look at a picture of him and you're like, oh, traumatic flashback. Like this, sure. At this time, this is what he's dealing with emotionally. Yeah, that tracks.
And also, at least there was a point for it.
Yeah, it was Mother's Day. Like, sure, yeah. He's going to be thinking about Martha. Martha!
And that's because a drugged-up Batman would eventually find his way over to Crime Alley. A family, much like the Waynes, stumbles upon him, and they are pretty freaked out by this dude in a bat costume in a random alley, so they just run off. I think this also has to deal a little bit with what Alfred and Bruce kind of talk about later on in the movie, about how the city is a bit fractured. Everybody, they don't want to help each other and stuff like that. I think that's what that was trying to play off of. But also, I think doing a bat costume in a random alley would...
Yeah. I mean, to be fair,
I would recommend people run away.
Yeah, no, to be fair, it is Gotham City. Like, people running around in costumes does not typically end well. So, this family, you know, these parents, they had a kid to think about. That's valid. Maybe if, you know, Martha and Thomas had thought twice about going down an alley, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So, you know.
Catwoman eventually finds and saves Batman again. She tries to snap him out of it, but Bruce passes out, but not before confusing Selina for his mother, which is due to the fear toxin and maybe some underlying issues Bruce has.
Bruce, you need to talk to somebody?
This section of the film doesn't take up too much time. It probably takes up the least amount of time when it comes to like cramming in story beats and character development. But it does continue to develop Bruce's mindset, Catwoman's character a little bit, and another supervillain escaping from Arkham Asylum. It's really all just set up before we get to the holiday killer investigation again. Any thoughts on this?
Main thought is I like the way they changed the art style during the Scarecrow sequence. It did actually look a bit more similar to the Tim Sale art style, which, you know, it was freaky because they were doing, you know, like throwing heads and whatnot. That part was freaky looking. I didn't care for that just from a visual sense because I was like, ew, scary. But, you know, if they had done something more similar to that more exaggerated art style throughout the film, I would not have been too mad at it. I mean, obviously without the horror like tinge to it, because you shouldn't be, you know, pissing your pants just watching Bruce sip a cup of tea, but you know what I mean, just the more elongated ears, like the slimmer features, you know, stuff like that.
I think what I loved about this is kind of what I was talking about earlier, but not in detail, and that's Bruce's inexperience as Batman. It's just, I think also we talked about this a lot in our spoiler talk for The Batman and why we love that movie so much, is we're seeing the journey for him to become the world's greatest detective, for him to become the OP hero that everybody's like, oh, he's Batman. How does he know that? Because he's Batman. I want to see the journey of that sometimes. And I love this movie for really going into that while having somebody like Harvey Dent, to me, be the focus of the movie. It was just very well done from a writing perspective. So I thought that was really cool to have Scarecrow kind of beat him, because Batman's inexperienced. He's like, oh, I'll stop the gas. I'll have a gas mask on. Oh, nope.
Like, he can also just stab you. I don't have a syringe-proof costume.
Yep.
It's not bullets, but not a syringe, guys.
He'll learn from it. He'll adapt, because, you know, he's Batman. But, and also, like I said, goes with the Catwoman stuff about Catwoman saves his life twice in the first 25 minutes of this movie, it feels like. And it really helps you really be on Catwoman's side the entire time, being like, come on, Batman. Come on, man.
Come on, Bruce.
Let's move on, though, to Father's Day. So right before Father's Day, Sophia Falcone, Carmine's daughter, pays Carmine a visit to give him a Father's Day present and to ask for a seat at the table. It's then revealed that Sophia was the one who orchestrated Scarecrow's escape. Carmine immediately refuses because he thinks people would see it as him setting up a potential successor. He also thinks it would make him look weak and old. As saddened, Sophia eventually accepts her father's wishes, but before she walks off, she spots and gets freaked out by Scarecrow waiting in Carmine's office, because that dude's just pretty creepy.
I mean, the dude dressed as a scarecrow. It's pretty unsettling. If I was walking, into an office building and I saw that guy standing there, I might be pretty unsettled myself.
It's also a bit of a contrast with Sophia and Alberto, how they, I don't want to say behave around their dad, but that's kind of what they do. Like,
they interact
more confrontational. Yeah. To where he was more confrontational and like, no, trust me, I know more about business than you do. And the daughter just accepts it. So you can kind of tell why Carmine loves the daughter more than the son right there in that one interaction. On Father's Day, we see Salvatore Moroni about to visit his father, Luigi Moroni. It's revealed that Salvatore and Sophia Falcone have been doing the old devil's tango. Salvatore says Sophia should wait in the car because Luigi would probably die if he saw them together. During the visit, Luigi offers Salvatore some advice to make peace with your enemy. But before he could elaborate any further, Luigi is shot and killed by the Holiday Killer. Salvatore runs after the Holiday Killer, but they get away. We do see Sophia and Holiday in the same place, though, so she can pretty much be eliminated as a suspect at this point. As for our protagonist, Bruce is being questioned by Gordon and Harvey since Bruce is signing off assets to Carmine Falcone. Bruce says all this has been reversed because he was being controlled and manipulated by Poison Ivy. Harvey, who is getting a little more unstable with each passing scene, notes that the Waynes and the Falcones have a past. Turns out Thomas Wayne once saved Carmine's life, and the Waynes essentially legitimized the Falcones. Real quick, before we get into this any further, there is a debate online I see sometimes about how the Waynes are, and I think you've talked about this in the past. How do you feel about the Waynes being involved with the Falcones?
I mean, I'm fine with it to, like, this extent and the extent which we see it in The Batman, where the Waynes are decent people. And it's just like, oh, well, you know, we just happen to know people. Like, we don't actually want to work with them or anything. But, you know, when you're this powerful in this city, you're going to occasionally rub elbows with you know, those who are really in control of it. And I mean, Thomas Wayne took the Hippocratic Oath. He's not going to let somebody die, you know? So I think that's a good bit of characterization. But I'm not one of the ones like, oh, I love it when the Waynes are, you know, corrupt and you know, really, you know, part of the dark side of Gotham. Because then I feel like if that's the case, like just already establishing them as villains, it kind of takes away not just from the impact of Bruce's memory of his parents, but also, like, this, there's a Batman villain called Dr. Hurt who, like, claims to be Thomas Wayne, but really evil, and that's just a, it's a real big part of the foundation of Grant Morrison's Batman run, and if you make the Waynes really evil all along, it kind of takes away from that, and it's just, yeah, so I like his parents being good people.
We then get a flashback of Carmine's father rushing Carmine into the Wayne Manor. He says Carmine was shot by Luigi Moroni and pleads with Thomas to save his son's life. A young Bruce Wayne looks on as Thomas completes the surgery. After Thomas and Carmine's father leave Carmine to rest, Bruce walks up to him, and this is where these two characters first meet. I'm sure we'll talk about it in the discussion a few times, but one thing said by Falcone during this interaction is, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, the only thing we get in this world is what we take. And speaking of Carmine, in the present day, we see Catwoman following Carmine into the cemetery, the same cemetery where Alberto was buried. While there, Carmine meets a hitman. Who does Carmine want dead? Who is this hitman? We don't know yet. Figure out in the next episode of Dragon Ball Z. And Salvatore Moroni also offers Harvey Dent a deal. Moroni will flip on the Falcones if the DA drops all warrants against the Moronis. A lot of stuff happened on Father's Day, apparently.
It's a lot.
We can talk about so much here, from Sophia and Salvatore Moroni, Scarecrow being involved with the mob, the flashback with Bruce, all sorts of other things. Where do you want to start, man?
Well, we kind of touched on it already, just the relationship between Sophia and Carmine, but I really enjoy that aspect of this adaptation and, you know, the comics, because that then her relationship with her father plays out in the sequel comic Dark Victory. It's just, I think it's a very interesting dynamic. I think it humanizes Falcone in a way that we don't frequently see in adaptations. I mean, we get more about his interiority in the Batman, but we see, oh no, he's just a total piece of shit, like, awful person. Whereas with this, yes, he is, like, you know, a ganglord and whatnot, and he's not necessarily a very
there's layers
yeah
to
but
him.
There's layers, like, he's like, he clearly loves his yeah. his daughter, like, he's not,
and I think to an extent he loves his son,
yeah,
but he's just so set in his old ways, he thinks he has this code. And then you see in the post credit scene, I'm a little disappointed I didn't see the post credit scene first time watching, though, because it does really, it shows Carmine is willing to go there.
Yeah.
That all that talk about him not crossing a certain line, that at his own son's funeral, he'll take somebody that I'm sure he's embellishing when he's like, Bruce Wayne, I see him as the son I never had. But it does feel like throughout the first movie, there's some implications that he respects Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
And at the post credit scene,
what his dad did for him, you know?
Yeah. And they had that, we see in this flashback, and there's just that bond between the two in that moment. And you see that, yeah, he says he has that code and all that, but he just said, fuck Bruce Wayne, I'm just going to let Poison Ivy take him over. And the post-credit scene, so that, man, he's a complex character, for sure. I don't know how to feel about him.
You don't want to say you like him, but he's interesting.
Scarecrow being involved with the mob, we'll talk about that changing of the guard, but I see this more as, like, Falcone. He talks with his daughter later on, saying... Mm-hmm. Haven't I always adapted? I've always changed with the times. I'm not some old man who doesn't know what's coming. It's him trying to see ahead, but he doesn't see that he's already extinct.
Yeah. I mean,
that's the part of it I love, man.
As soon as you've got these, you know, 17 different supervillains running around, it's like, Carmine, hey, pal, I don't think it's going to work out for you there, Chief.
It's the part of it I love, that he still thinks, I can come out on top of this. I can control these quote-unquote freaks, as he calls them. And he can't. They're just, it's a new era of Gotham. I talked about that last week, too, that one of the through lines of this movie is not just the Holiday Killer or Harvey Dent. It is that changing of the guard.
Mm-hmm.
That out go the mobsters, in come all the crazy supervillains. What's going on? And we're seeing that less of, oh, it's just comics, and more of a logical storyline reason. And I fucking love that. I didn't think that was going to happen in this story at all. I was just expecting this serial killer story. And instead, we got this, like I said, changing of the guard in Gotham. And it was played into the theme, Loved it.
I agree. Let me see, what else do we have from this section? I like the flashback with Bruce and Garmon. I think it's a badass line. The only thing we get in this life is what we take.
The coin bit is really fucking cool. Because we see that in part one that Batman has the two-sided coin. And Drew and I actually made a joke saying, like, why does Batman even have that? I forgot about that it was Carmine's. And he just kept it all these years. And eventually will go to Harvey. And Harvey would eventually change it. And that will also lead to Carmine's death. It's fucking great, man.
Layers, man.
Anything else?
Not from this section, no.
All right, let's talk about the old 4th of July.
Let's talk about the old Independence Day.
This is where everything pops off. And again, no pun intended there. Harvey, Gilda, and the Gordons are attending Gotham's 4th of July celebration. Many Gotham citizens, now terrified about another holiday killer attack, stay home, so it's a low turnout. Carmine Falcone, however, does make a huge public appearance and is doing everything he can to antagonize Harvey. Turns out the hitman Carmine hired is going after Harvey. Catwoman once again shows up to save the day. However, the hitman would eventually knock them both out. This attempt on his life seemed to really push Harvey over the edge. He starts to hear a gruff voice inside of his head urging him to get up. Harvey then wakes up to see the hitman dead with all the holiday killer signatures, the gun, and holiday-themed items on the ground in front of him. Harvey runs away before the GCPD can find him near the body. As this section goes on, we see Harvey continue to really unravel.
This man's and spiraling.
That voice, yeah, and that voice, it just gets a little bit louder just each time. He and Gilda are on the verge of splitting up. Carla Vitti, who is Carmine's sister, is accusing him of being the holiday killer on TV. And the Falcone case would fall apart due to Moroni's testimony. But more on that here in a minute. If you're wondering what Batman was doing during all this...
Oh, just, you know, vibing.
He was chasing after Scarecrow. Scarecrow was robbing a bank. Batman tried to stop him. Mad Hatter knocked him out, revealing that Scarecrow had a partner. And the two villains took Batman back to the cemetery, along with the money they stole for Falcone. It's Batman, though, so of course he escapes, defeats them both, sending them right back to Arkham. And then Batman turns his attention right back to the holiday killer. After the 4th of July attack, he believes Harvey Dent may be the real killer after all. So that's pretty much where his sights are set the remainder of the movie. In Harvey's basement, he finds evidence that Harvey is the killer, including one of the holiday killer's guns. We'll talk about this Falcone case here in the next section here, man, but there was a lot of character building and story development here, especially for Harvey Dent. And there was also some Batman action. So, what are your thoughts on all this? Feel free to start wherever you want.
I want to talk about Harvey. Harvey is one of my favorite Batman villains, especially one of, like, in terms of the classic rogues that you think of. Harvey Dent is definitely in my top echelon of Batman baddies. And I think this whole sequence is where we really start, like, this is where we start to finally see Two-Face. For the last two movies, for the last movie and a half, like, Josh Schimmel's been killing it as Harvey Dent. And you can see, like, sure, okay, he's, you know, willing to work with the Batman. Like, he's really invested in this. You know, he's putting his own well-being and, you know, the well-being of his relationship, like, at risk to stop this case, or to finish this case and stop Falcone. But, you know, you still see him as that sort of, like, moral, not necessarily authority, but a moral man. And with this, it's like, okay, no, like, yeah, like, we've seen hints of his instability before, but now it's like the cracks are really starting to show, and it's like, yeah, okay, yeah, this is not going to end well for Harvey at all. Like, his Two-Face is knocking on the door, and I just think that's the way that Josh Duhamel is able to differentiate between Harvey and then that inner Two-Face monologue. Like, I really dig that. Honestly, it's the level of quality I was hoping for Jensen Ackles with his Batman voice, you know?
Yeah, I really love this for Harvey's character development. I agree with you to an extent about Harvey being one of my personal favorite Batman villains.
Mm-hmm.
The only caveat I would put to that is when done right.
Yeah.
because don't get me wrong,
I don't talk shit about Tommy Lee Jones.
He did a great job. No, he did. He did a great job. I'm really not crapping on it, especially for what that movie is. He does a phenomenal job for what they wanted that Two-Face to be. However, that is a very one-dimensional Two-Face.
Yes.
For what's supposed to be a multi-layered character. Which is very ironic. Compared to, like, to bring the Chris Nolan trilogy back to what we saw in The Dark Knight and what we see here, which I think this is better, but I think they do a little more with Harvey here, so I think that's the reason why.
Mm.
It's just, you see the cracks that you were talking about earlier. You see the part in part one where Harvey's talking about, you know, if we were different men, we would take this money from Falcone.
It's a good line.
It doesn't make him a bad person.
He's aware of the situation. Yes.
It shows like him to say that also to Batman, it shows like, oh man, he's not uncorruptible. He can be corrupted. That's that one little line, I think it was so well written there, to just throw that in there to show, like, nope, he can be corrupted some way down the line. And throughout this movie and throughout part two, you would see just him really unravel, people starting to turn against him. It's so well done, man, in so many different ways. We're about to get into it more, but one of the things, too, that I'd look at my interpretation of it is that during the 4th of July attack is when we first hear Two-Face.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's the first time that voice has come out.
Oh, no, it's 100% not. He had, if I recall correctly, I want to say that Harvey was abused as a kid. I want to say that his dad beat him. So, like, he developed multiple personalities. I could be wrong about that. Hold on. I'm going to do some research on that.
Also, for the interpretation of this movie, I kind of also take it as possibly Gilda uses him to kind of as her weapon to, like, I'm just going to use him. It's like the one sin she really commits to me as somebody who I like the Punisher. I like characters like Red Hood. She's killing these horrible mobsters who are, you know, doing these terrible things. You learn about what happens to Gilda later.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, this is the big spoiler of the movie, so if you hadn't seen the movie yet, yeah, that's who the Holiday Killer is. But it's the big sin I think she commits is she really fucks up Harvey, man.
Yeah. Okay, see, and I was right. Yeah, so his dad was an alcoholic who would beat him regularly, but like he would decide whether or not he was gonna beat him by flipping his lucky coin, which is then.
So that's not what they're doing for this interpretation.
Yeah, that's not what they're doing with this.
The dad part.
But yeah, so then he develops DID.
Yeah, so I think my interpretation of like Two-Face, we hear him for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
When you watch part one again, and there are those moments, and I'm like, were they trying to go for Two-Face was urging him to take that money or something? Mm-hmm. And Harvey, you know, just those moments, it makes you look back at it.
Yeah, you're like, Harvey, what are you trying to say to us?
I wonder if you had two personalities in there, man. Or if you were just being a reasonable man who had a moment of doubt. It's just very interesting. And again, they do such a good job with this character. And as I mentioned before, Harvey's case against the Falcones completely unravels due to Salvatore Moroni double-crossing him on the stand by saying Carmine is a stand-up guy. It's revealed that Moroni, with the help of Sophia, brokered a deal with Carmine, and the two powerful mobs are now united against Harvey. This double-cross seems to be the final straw for Harvey as he goes into almost a complete breakdown. Moroni then accuses Harvey of being the Holiday Killer and throws acid in his face. Moroni says that stuff would eat through concrete. I love that line, by the way. It shows acid's bad. Like,
that's acid, period. not good stuff. Not sure why it stopped, like, you know, at his muscles, but.
But I like the description to show you like how painful this must be, and then all the while we're hearing Josh Duhamel scream in fucking agony.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, okay, I get it. This is terrible. On the roof, Batman and Gordon meet up to discuss the possibility of Harvey being the Holiday Killer, and this is when Batman shows the evidence to Gordon, They rush downstairs when they hear everyone screaming. To kind of shorten this summary a bit, I'm going to trim past a few things. I'm just going to skim past it. Basically, Harvey wakes up in a hospital and his other half finally takes over. Two-Face is officially born. The GCPD all think Harvey is the killer. Two-Face escapes from the hospital, again, after getting a call from Falcone to meet him in an undisclosed location, after realizing Carmine was never going to meet him and this meet was just another attempt on his life, Two-Face kills Carmine's goons and escapes to the sewers where he meets and enlists Solomon Grundy.
Born on a Monday. Plan.
We then fast forward to Carmine's birthday. They're all gloating over destroying Harvey Dent when the elevator opens to reveal Carla Vitti has been murdered by Holiday. How do you think, we kind of talked about this earlier, but how do you think this movie handles Two-Face's origin?
It's fantastic to me personally. I'm a big fan, as I said. I don't even know if I can necessarily say it's my favorite, because outside of Batman Forever, like, I feel like most of the adaptations we've gotten of Two-Face have been, like, all pretty solid, at least in terms of his origin, because there's, you know, there's The Dark Knight, there's Batman the Animated Series, even the Telltale Batman games.
The one that gets me is it The Dark Knight Returns? Or mm-hmm. Two-Face, he has the other half of his face.
We finally get surgically fixed. Yeah.
It's so sad, too, man, to see how that ends for him. And I don't know why at all. It's not the best. It's just so one of the most memorable, I'll say that, for Two-Face stories.
Yeah. So this is, like I said, I don't necessarily know if I can 100% say it's my favorite Two-Face origin adaptation, but it is in the conversation.
Yeah, for me, it's high up there. This is such a great character. It's really, to me, like character dissection of Harvey Dent. The good, the bad, everything in between. And what we see from Two-Face from here on out, and then also the ending, is just, it's chef's kiss for me. Like, the part where he knows, like, Two-Face knows, all right, Carmine's goons are about to kill me. Oh shit, I'm going to pretend that I'm still on the phone with him so I can get the upper hand. It's smart.
Smart, man.
It's, you don't see smart. That much with the writing, the where the characters have these badass moments. He falls into the water with a goon, breaks his neck, escapes. And just very smart. He's very brutal. It shows just not only is Two-Face just that guy with the acid on one side of his face and a weird suit, but he's also a physical threat as well, even though he doesn't have superpowers.
Mm-hmm. God, Two-Face is so
funny. You ready to go to Labor Day, or you got anything else about Two-Face? We're gonna be talking about Two-Face more.
Yeah, I mean, he's like one of the main people in this movie, so yeah, I'm ready.
So on Labor Day, Salvatore Moroni is being transported. Two-Face and Grundy stop the convoy, and we get a huge confrontation between Batman and Gordon and the man formerly known as Harvey Dent. During this confrontation, Batman reveals he found the gun in Dent's basement. Two-Face is shocked to hear this, but then he immediately figures out who Holiday really is. Moroni is then killed by the real Holiday. Two-Face and Grundy would eventually escape right after this. I do love the bit that, like, Two-Face and Grundy have a great scene before this. We didn't talk about that. And it repeats that the whole poem with Solomon Grundy, and then he enlists him, like, you know what? I have your back, man. We should be friends. You know
what? Ride or die. Let's go.
It's an underrated relationship in this movie to me, because I just find it like, that pairing shouldn't work, but I like it. It really does fit for me. But there's one bit in this scene that I loved, and that's when they're trying to escape, and Grundy's on the ground, and Two-Face is just like, get off your ass, Grundy. Let's go. It's like, the way Dumel delivers the line is so funny. Behind up. Yeah, the way Dumel delivers that is just so great. But the rest of this section is focused on Batman's investigation into the Holiday Killer and the Waynes' connection to the Falcones. Bruce is struggling with why his parents did what they did years ago. Carmine is starting to really fall apart. And Batman just can't figure out the final piece of the puzzle when it comes to the Holiday Killer. But the big reveal here happens when Catwoman once again shows up to help Batman against Falcone. When asked why she's doing this, Selina says that she never knew her mother, but she knows Carmine is her father. She wants Carmine to tell her what her mom's name was. Again, they packed a lot of story beats in this movie, especially compared to
part
one.
Well, because in the, I don't know if Drew mentioned this last week, but this is sort of a beat in the long Halloween comic, and this
whole,
be
adapted
plot
to
line
the Batman.
Catwoman being like, oh, Falcone's my dad. Like, it gets its own little, like, separate side story, like, comic. It's called Catwoman When in Rome. Like, that's why she just disappears for a lot of the story. And then comes back. She's like, yeah, okay, yeah, I'm back. Also, I think Falcone's my dad.
I think it also, to me, on the subject of Catwoman, it gives her... It's going to sound weird. It's going to sound like, oh, you gave her just a little bit of story because she doesn't have much screen time. Mm-hmm. But I think it really gives reasoning to a lot of what she does, because at the beginning of the movie, she's a villain. And throughout the rest of the part one and part two, she really starts to lean over towards that heroic side. And one of the big reasons why is not really because she wants to be a hero, but more so just because she's following Falcone.
Yeah.
And trying to stop
him. She's like, what's this guy's beef? Is he my daddy or not?
She's trying to figure that out. It kind of sounds like she wants to stop him and also figure that out and talk to him too. So it's a three-headed dragon with her motivations here that all makes sense. And like I said, I think it really gives her character... It gives the reason why she keeps popping up when she pops up. Instead of the audience just going, oh, Deus Ex Machina right there, it's Catwoman. No, she's there all the time watching Falcone.
Now, since she's Catwoman, would be a Deus Ex Paw-kina or Claw-kina?
Ah, see what you did there.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on this story, though, as it comes to a close and how it deals with Two-Face's origins with Grundy, basically, here?
Like you said, I agree that the Two-Face Grundy dynamic is something that's underrated in this movie. And it is a thing that's present in the comic, too. But then you never really see it again, ever, in the comics. And then, kind of makes me sad. I mean, it's partially because at the time that this storyline came out, like, that dynamic was a retcon. And, by that point, Grundy didn't really... show up in Gotham that much. He's typically running around being just a hench goon or whatever and taking on like the Justice League or the Justice Society as a whole instead of just Batman. But I like that dynamic. I like Two-Face finally like becoming Two-Face, like you said, showing that even without powers, like he's still a threat. Like Harvey Dent, he's a big dude. Like, and that's something that I feel like a lot of the adaptations haven't necessarily, like, done super well. Like, Harvey Dent is a large man. There's a reason why, even though he's not, trained in 127 different martial arts, like, Batman still is going to come out on top during the fight, but Harvey does not go out without a fight. Like, it's not the same as if he's fighting, the Mad Hatter or whatever. Like, Harvey's going to get his licks in. And as for, like, the downfall of the Roman and whatnot, I really, really enjoy it. I do think that we can talk more about that, like, once we get to the actual, like, the real downfall of Carmine, but I do like the way they're setting it up now and the teases we get of Catwoman being like, well, it's not much of a tease. She's like, yeah, he's my dad. It's a bit more teased out in the comic, but no, this whole section, for me, the main draw is... Harvey's turn.
Yeah, totally. And one thing, last thing I'll say, because we didn't really talk about Solomon Grundy himself too much. We were talking about just the pairing. But Solomon Grundy's story, it adds this level of not even fantasy to where it's like, oh, we have Joker and Riddler and Two-Face and all that. There's a level of creepiness to him.
Yeah. It's been
and
not macabre.
He's been there forever. So it's well, Gotham had that, it's somewhat rooted in normalcy, that there's mob bosses and all that stuff and corruption in a city. Like, we've seen that story before.
Yeah.
What this does is like, no, Solomon Grundy's been living in the sewer as a myth, and this is pretty much a big ass zombie.
Yeah, it's like you've got all these mobsters and their gang wars. You also got a zombie Hulk just hanging out under Main Street.
I wish there would be some adaptation. I don't want him to be the focus villain. I don't think that would work. But more than what we usually get with a character, which for me has been like Arkham City and this. That's pretty much it. So we'll see, I guess, with Solomon Grundy's future in any DC projects.
I mean, hey, put him in the Batman.
I think it's going to be a hot take because they're going so, I guess they're going realistic with it. But
yeah, so was Arrow. Arrow was going realistic, and then we got fucking Crisis on Infinite Earths. So
you know. I think it would fit, though.
I don't think it would fit.
In the Batman. But, so the movie this... So the ending of this movie is action-packed. Two-Face's big plan is to stage a massive breakout in Arkham Asylum and storm Carmine's place. He thinks that the system is completely corrupt, and the only way to take down men like Carmine is to lower yourself to their level and beat them at their own game. The plan works out pretty well, all things considered. Sophia gets crushed and is seemingly killed. They all have Carmine cornered when Batman and Catwoman swoop in. They defeat all the supervillains, but Two-Face does end up fatally wounding Falcone. As for Sophia, she survived the initial attack, but she doesn't make it to her father in time. She is ultimately killed when she trips over one of Poison Ivy's weeds and falls to her death. I know that sounds a lot lamer. It sounds pretty lame.
Is she dead, though?
I'd say so.
I mean, in the comics, she's not, but...
She survives that in the comics?
Oh, yeah. She just walks around with a big-ass neck brace for all of Dark Victory. She's also in the wheelchair for a lot of it, but it turns out, you know, not really in the wheelchair. It's a whole thing. But yeah, no, in the comics, she lives. Although, I can't remember if she gets thrown out of a window that high in the comic.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if she was, like, in another Batman adaptation with a neck brace. I would be very surprised to see that.
I mean, hey, but, stranger things have happened. I mean, it's like the neck brace, but like the one with like the headgear, you know, where it's like they get a band around the head and it's like the four like metal rods or whatever, like into the shoulders to like keep their head up straight.
Yeah. God, that sounds so painful.
Oh, no, it sounds awful. It looks awful. Like it seems really, really difficult.
But it does sound a lot lamer out loud than what happens on screen. She's in shock. Catwoman tries to save her half-sister. Sophia does end up letting go because it'll kill them both. It's a whole dramatic thing. It's a lot better than the way I put it. Selina takes off her mask and a dying Carmine mistakenly calls her Luisa, revealing that was her mother's name. And that pretty much is Selina's cue to be like, well, I'm the fuck out. See you later, Bruce.
Like, and done. It's like, I got what I wanted.
Yep. Before dying, Batman repeats what Carmine told him all those years ago. The only thing we get in this world is what we take. Carmine asks if Bruce still believes that, and the latter says that he does. I want to go ahead and talk about this part. We can talk about the rest of this later. What I love about this is, to me, the implication that Carmine knew that Bruce Wayne was Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just that, I'm not going to tell your secret, kid.
Well, if he didn't know before, he at least knows in this scene.
Yeah. Well, the fact he wasn't shocked to hear that, and there was no hesitation between Bruce saying what he said, that's repeating that quote, and then Carmine asking, do you still believe that? So that made it to me seem like, no, he knew this entire time.
Yeah.
Which I thought was just a great detail for the character.
It's definitely a cool exchange, that's for damn sure.
1 year to the day from when they all made that pact on the GCPD rooftop, Harvey once again explains his actions. Gordon says Harvey betrayed everything he ever believed in. Harvey replies that he didn't betray everything and proceeds to turn himself in.
What a G'd up moment.
Man, I gotta admit, the whole rooftop scene with Harvey at the end could be my favorite scene in the entire movie.
That's some good shit.
What did you think of the whole final act and that scene?
It's a damn good act. Like, it does feel like it wraps up a bit quickly, just because so much of it is action. You know, just Batman and Catwoman fighting every other.
Only problem I have is Joker. Joker and maybe Penguin don't really fit in that rogues that they had. for that sequence, because Penguin just, oh, there he is. He was in like part one for half a second when they were going to Calendar Man.
Yeah.
But Joker, pretty much, he's set dressing. It's what you're talking about. He's just there to say like two funny lines. And as much as I'm Jokered out, I'm just sitting there like, he is number one on Batman's rogues list. He's not going to be sitting there behind Harvey
Dent. But also at this point, this was year two of him being Batman. So like, really all Joker's done aside from random killings is he tried to poison Gotham's water supply. You know, like they don't have that same storied relationship. And I mean, obviously I do agree with you. Like he is just there in this. And so is Penguin, at least in the comics. Like he had interacted with, like Penguin had more appearances in this story. Like it wasn't like, oh, Penguin secretly pulling the strings, but he had apprehended Penguin like once or twice, like actually in the story. So it wasn't just, you know, you see him walk past him in Arkham Asylum. It's like, oh no, he's already threw Penguin in jail earlier in the movie because Penguin was stealing something or whatever.
And that's also because the movie in part one did, and when I say the movie, I mainly just mean both parts. But with these movies, they did such a good job at building those villains and showing you them before this big climactic ending. So those two, to me, Joker just being set dressing and also being like, wait, what the fuck is Penguin doing here?
Yeah.
It really throws you aside.
Like, Oswald, who let you in here?
But other than that, like, yeah, man, this is a great final act, great final sequence. What are your thoughts on this? This was the personification of the new age is here. The mobs are dead. Yeah. What are your thoughts on that, man?
I think it's an idea that we've seen in a lot of other Batman adaptations. Like, the biggest example of that is in The Dark Knight, which is largely based on this, where, you know, the Joker's like, oh, you've changed things, you know, like, they're never going to be the same. Or even at the beginning of, or not the beginning, the end of Batman Begins, when Gordon's talking about, oh, there's this, like, war of escalation, like, you've changed things, and now we've got someone like the Joker running around. So, to see it here on this scale, where it's like, yeah, no, it's not just dealing with one or two villains, it's, no, this is a whole, like, this is a thing now. Like, you've got this many criminals running around, and I think it plays a little bit better in the comic, just because of, you know, like I said, with things like, oh, yeah, you already seen him apprehend Penguin once or twice, like, you have this idea already when you're reading the comic that, yeah, these are all people that he's had to deal with more than once. And you kind of get that in this movie, but because it's a movie and it's going to be experienced by probably a larger audience than just the comics, there is that sort of, I wouldn't necessarily say implication, but a general expectation that, like, there needs to be, there's a general expectation of exposition on the part of a movie, you know, when they're just introducing random characters. So when you just see them all pop up together towards the end, like you're saying, it can be a bit jarring. Like, oh yeah, Joker and Penguin are just here. Whereas when it's in the comics, you're like, okay, no, I know what I'm in for. This is Batman. He's been running around. He's been taking out these guys. Like, so when you finally see them all together, it's like, oh, wow, yeah, no, he's been doing this, like, he's had some experience. But either way, seeing all of these classic rogues together personifying, like, hey, we're fucking in charge now, bitch. It's like, yeah, it's cool as shit.
Yeah, and like I said, it works so much with Falcone's character that he is the smartest of all the mobsters we see in this movie. But even he could not, like, outrun just the natural order of things, which was, we were going to go to that supervillains in Gotham, because to me, Batman, it's not like he physically creates it, but it does feel like unintentionally he has fostered that new, it's kind of what you're talking about, what Heath Ledger says in Dark Knight. Joker in Dark Knight says, you've changed things forever. Things are going to be different now. That's kind of where the Batman character typically goes, and that's what I think they're going for here.
I agree.
As for the rooftop scene, man, this was so good. What I love the most about it is it just shows that there was a line earlier in the movie where Two-Face tells Harvey, he's like, I'm sorry nobody told you, man, but you're already dead. That was just such a fucking chilling line. But it kind of shows at the end of the movie, no, Harvey wasn't. There's a little bit of him still there. To him, that's what he had to do to take down the mob. That it was a conscious decision for him to pull himself down to the level and be a villain.
Yeah. God, see, this is why I like Two-Face.
I know. It's so good. And you don't see that in a lot of adaptations, I feel like. And at least, I'm sure you do in the comics.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm saying, for me, as somebody who just watches DC content a lot, that I don't really see that level of depth. And I want to see that level of depth. This is what I want to see, because I felt like Harvey, and it doesn't make him a hero at the end. It doesn't really even make him an anti-hero. He does some shitty things.
No, he is a villain.
But at the same time, there's a little bit of nobility behind his intention of what he's doing.
And that just adds to the tragedy.
It's the thing we say about a lot of like MCU villains. It's cool motive still murder, though. And it adds to the tragedy of the character as well, that makes you just love the character. But you know it's never going to work out for the character. So let's go ahead and talk about the ending, though. Because this is not the ending. Because we still don't know who Holiday is, even though I already spoiled it earlier in this episode. It's ultimately revealed that Gilda was the Holiday killer all along. I know, shocked. Nobody could have figured that one out.
Did not see it coming.
She and Alberto Falcone got together. She got pregnant. They got married the same day they found out. But Carmine did not accept her because the child was conceived out of wedlock. So Carmine forced them to annul the marriage and abort the baby. Gilda eventually moved to Gotham, married Harvey, and enacted her revenge plan to destroy the mobs who did this to her. Batman asks if the Holiday killer is done, and Gilda says it's finished now. So Batman lets her go, and that's how the movie ends. There's also a sequence, because the movie does end on Halloween, where Bruce and Selina are shown together again. It is Halloween night. Bruce thinks that nobody's coming out for holiday night. People are still too frightened. Then a child comes up to the door, dressed as Batman. I thought it was a really sweet scene.
That's pretty sweet.
It was just a very sweet scene to show, like, you know what? For all the consequences, the bad consequences of Batman, there are some good ones too. So it was just really cool. And there is a post-credit scene teasing the next few DC movies or whatever it is. I'll eventually watch those. I'm sure you will too, but it's not important for this specific movie. What is important, though, is the Holiday Killer. So although Gilda was revealed to be the Holiday Killer, I think this reveal still leaves some room for theories and some interesting discussion about Gilda, whether Batman should have let her go, and just how much or little others may have used Holiday for their own benefit. What's your take on it? I know in the comics, it's a completely different thing.
Yeah. I mean, in the comics, she is still at least partially the Holiday Killer. Like, she definitely killed a few people. But there's more wiggle room. It's like, well, but she didn't do all the killings. Like, did Alberto Falcone actually do a few? Because in the comics, he takes the blame. Like, he claims, yeah, I'm Holiday. I mean, Harvey also says, yeah, I committed the Holiday killings. But, like, Alberto also ends up in prison, like, across from Calendar Man, and they just go back and forth naming holidays, trying to stump each other, being like, I'm the best holiday-themed murderer. And in the
speaking comic, of Calendar Man, we didn't mention this in the last act. I thought it was hilarious that Calendar Man wanted to get out of there so bad, but they would have let him out if he just picked heads. He picked tails. So he was left in Arkham Asylum while everybody else got to break out. I thought it was hilarious.
But also, in the comic, Bruce doesn't confront Gilda. Like, he didn't really figure it out. So there's less of a window of like, oh, did he let her go? Personally, I don't think he should have let her go, because, you know, like, cool motive, still murder. She killed a lot of people, and Batman's all about, like, justice.
But, we're about to wrap up. Before we go, let's go over our final pros and cons for Batman The Long Halloween Part 2, along with our final thoughts. Tristan, what are your final thoughts on Batman The Long Halloween Part 2?
Solid follow-up to Part 1. I think it's impossible to talk about either of these movies without talking about the other overall. So if you're going to watch them, you know, watch them together. Don't just watch one, because that'd be weird. I mean, Unless you're watching them as they were coming out. That makes sense. But now that both of them are out, if you're going to watch them, watch it all at once. But overall, I think it's a pretty solid adaptation of the Fantastic comic. I think overall the cast as well. I think sometimes Jensen Ackles can be a little stiff, and also Naya Rivera a little bit. But for the most part, I think they're solid. I think Josh Duhamel steals the show. The art style is solid. I wish they'd gone with something a bit more stylistic, but I get why they didn't. Overall, I enjoy Batman: The Long Halloween parts 1 and 2.
Yeah, I think it's very important to group both of them together. Be like, all right, make sure you're watching both as like one big movie here, because that's the best way, I think, to watch it. It's not the best Batman movie I've ever seen.
No.
Not the best Batman animated movie that I've ever seen. To me, I think that's still Under the Red Hood. But this is a damn good movie, and I was very shocked. And again, this is one of those, I talked about this in part one, like everything we're doing here and talking about these movies and TV shows, all this shit's subjective. It is 100% okay. People have different opinions, but I was a little shocked, like going online after watching the movie for the first time and seeing like how divisive it was.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was, oh yeah, this is pretty good. And a lot of people going like, oh my God, they strayed so far from the comic and the way it went there, and it's fucking awful. And I'm just like, wow. I thought this would have been one of the more, you were talking about like the new 52 Batman movies and the DC animated movies. I thought this would have been way more well received than those.
You would think.
But instead it feels like more in line with those. So I don't know if this is a thing where DC just overall needs to, which they do, they need to look at their animation for DC movies and do better and put more money into it. But yeah, man, it's, I was kind of just shocked by the reception from what I saw, but I loved it, man. I don't know what else to say. Great performances. Only con I have is probably just some animation bits that look a bit wonky, and maybe some pacing issues throughout parts 1 and 2, because they're cramming a lot in part 2 and things get slow in part 1.
Yeah, the pacing in general is, I don't know. It's one of those things where I can't even say, like, oh, well, you know, they had to do it this way to make things, you know, flow separately as two different movies.
But let's go ahead and get out of here, man. Let's talk about what we're working on and where can people find us. Tristan, what you're working on and where can the people find you?
As usual, I'm still putting out hits over at Screen Rant, so please go give me a view. I get paid per article views, so come on, y'all. Got bills to pay. As for where else you can find me on the socials, I'm on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at BackIssueBenz, all one word.
Be sure to, if you enjoyed anything you heard here today, be sure to take a look at our Discord. It is the best place to get into contact with us. If you want to talk with us about Batman: The Long Halloween, your thoughts on it, if you loved it, if you didn't like it, what are your thoughts on DC animated movies going forward? What you're thinking about other things, like, for example, She-Hulk Season 1, the upcoming Daredevil Born Again. There's some rumors going around about Spider-Man right now that have me very excited. So if you want to talk about anything nerdy like that, you want to talk about some video game stuff, Modern Warfare 2 is about to come out in a few weeks. So, or if you've played Overwatch 2 and want to vent about how bad it is or how great it is.
Or if you want to talk about Gotham Knights, which is coming out next week.
Yeah, I think it's coming out next week. I was kind of disappointed to hear that I don't think there's cross-platform, because I was going to suggest that the Nerds Top Movies team get together and do a deep dive discussion on a power-up in game for Gotham Knights.
I mean, what system do you have?
I have Xbox Series X. And I believe I remember you saying you had a PlayStation. So that automatically
better than you.
All right. Well, that was.
Nah, I'm just kidding.
That was a weird flex, but okay.
Nah. I'm
console
not better,
wars coming to life on Nerds Top Movies.
This is we're having a war here.
Also, if you enjoyed what you heard here today, consider leaving us a rating. It would also be awesome if it was a positive rating. If you love video games and are looking for another podcast to listen to, I know there's millions of them out
there. There's so many.
You may want to check out our gaming news podcast called Power Up and Game. On that podcast, we go over some of the trending news stories around the gaming industry. On occasion, we also have deep dive discussions best specific games, which are basically reviews, even though we don't like to call them that. Finally, be sure to check out thenerdstash.com for all sorts of news in the world of gaming, movies, television, and so much more. There's lists, guides, opinion pieces, you name it, you can find it on thenerdstash.com. The link for that is also in the description of this episode. I want to thank Tristan for joining me. I want to thank anyone for listening in. Tristan, real quick, I know you got to go here in a minute. I do want to plug an upcoming episode we're going to have here on another podcast. We've had the Super Bracket Bros. They're a fantastic podcast team. We had Jay from Super Bracket Bros appear on Nerds Talk Movies before. He talked with us about Jurassic Park.
A classic episode, I'd say.
We learned I thought a lot. It was a classic episode.
We covered a lot of ground. Just spoiler alert everyone for that episode. Don't fuck around with John Williams.
Yeah, also don't fuck around with John Williams. But there's not a lot of Jurassic Park talk. There's a lot of tangents too. So it was a classic episode for sure. But the reason I'm talking about this is Tristan and I will be on an upcoming episode of the Super Bracket Bros, where we will be talking about Red Hood versus Alex Vance from Half-Life. So we're gonna be talking about that, and I guess we're both gonna be talking about why Red Hood should win that fight. Probably.
I mean, he should.
So we'll see how that goes. It's gonna be interesting, and we'll probably plug this next week too. We'll see. We'll get with them to see when they're gonna post that episode. But I want to thank Tristan for joining me. I want to thank everyone for listening in. Our next two episodes of Nerd Stop Movies are gonna be very exciting for me, at least. First, we'll be doing a retrospective on what I personally believe to be the best season of superhero television ever.
That's high praise.
And that is Daredevil Season 3. And on the episode after that, oh man, I've been dreading and wanting to talk about this for a while. After we do our Daredevil episode, we'll be doing our spoiler talk on She-Hulk Season 1. A lot of people have a lot of opinions about this show, and I can't wait to jump in and add absolutely nothing of note to the conversation.
I like the show. Spoiler alert, everyone. Tristan likes She-Hulk.
We got probably about 30 seconds here. I like it. I think this past episode with Daredevil was easily the best of the season. I like a lot of Jen's arc, but man, that middle stretch of episodes, it left a lot on the table for me.
I mean,
so we'll see.
Didn't leave enough for me.
We'll see you next week with our retrospective on Daredevil Season 3.